You're free now. Free to stream beyond your wildest dreams. Free to be everything you imagine, and then some. That's how it feels to have Quantum Fiber. Your world unleashed. Learn more at quantumfiber.com. Limited availability. Service in select locations only.
Movie reviews and Hollywood news. The KSL Movie Show.
Welcome to another episode, another movie show bonus extra digital only episode of the movie show. I'm Andy Farnsworth, and I am pleased to be joined in this bonus extra. Now, just so you're aware, sometimes we don't have time in the movie show on our regular times on Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. to include all of the things that we'd like, especially interviews with local filmmakers and those who are releasing things in our market, or even the A-list Hollywood celebrities, which, we're always turning away, because we're such a big deal. But we are excited today to actually talk a movie coming out, releasing in Utah, and I believe nationally on Friday, February 23rd. I'm pleased to be joined for the movie The Stolen Valley, the writer, director, producer, Jesse Edwards. Jesse, you wore a lot of hats in making this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for having me, Andy. This is super exciting, and it's an honor to be able to chat about this.
Well, let's give the people a little bit of an idea of what is The Stolen Valley. I'm guessing that probably most of the people are going to see it after they've listened to this interview as opposed to before they've listened to this interview. So let's tell me what the Stolen Valley. I have a log line that the official studio, so I'll just, a Mexican Navajo mechanic joins a cowgirl to save her dying mother facing criminals and a corrupt landowner. As the director and writer, how would you, is that a good summary, or was there something else you'd like to summarize it?
Yeah, I mean, when people ask me, what's the movie about? I try to get a gauge, like, okay, how long do I have to explain this? Because, yeah, like, that log line's great. I think that explains what you're going to see, what the poster looks like. Those are the main characters. But what I always try to stress to people when I get a chance to say it is this is a film about redemption. That word is where I started with the movie. And that's what I want the whole thing to be about. How can we redeem the relationship between Native American people?
Okay, so then I guess that kind of leads into my next question, which is, what was the inspiration behind the storyline for Stolen Valley? Why did you want to tell this story?
So I had a friend down in Kanab, Utah, South Utah, and I've always wanted to make a movie. I mean, you know, since I was 12 years old, many decades ago. And there was a certain window where I knew I was turning 30. And that was my goal. Hey, I want to make a movie by the time I'm 30. And there was a film I live in Nashville. And there was a film we were planning to do here, and we were unable to pull it off just logistically. And my birthday was coming up, and I'm like, man, if I'm either going to keep making more, like, better excuses, more sophisticated excuses as to why I can't get a movie done, or I'm going to find a new way to do it. And I thought of Kelly, who I had worked with before down in South Utah. And I thought, man, if this was during 2020. So this was towards the end of that, right after the pandemic. And I thought, if there was a place where we needed to have a small amount of crew, shoot mostly exteriors, be outside, I would want to do it down in Kanab. And so I wrote a whole script for that area. And I started researching. So it looks like a Western movie there. So I'm not a huge fan of Westerns, not that I have anything against them. I didn't grow up watching them. I've seen, some of the great modern Westerns like Hell or High Water or No Country for Old Men. So I've seen things like that are just incredibly done. And so I thought, okay, what if I wrote a modern, neo-Western based in South Utah? What would be an important message? What would be a good why behind this film that's more than just, here's a writer-director who wrote about what he knows or made a movie about someone who looks just like him? I heard a fact at some point that was like, there was a huge percentage of first-time writer-directors are white males, and an even greater percentage of first-time feature films were starring white males. And I'm a white male, and I thought, man, this is a huge opportunity. This is a privilege and an honor to be in a position where, you know, I've worked hard. My brother and I have built a business. We've saved up money. We're able to make a feature film. I don't want to make this up. I don't want to represent an overly represented demographic. I don't want to tell a story that's not that, you know, there's redemption to be found in all stories, or that can be found in all stories. And there's beauty that can be written into any film, regardless of who the lead is or who's represented in it. But for me, I wanted to represent, if I could, with this one opportunity, you know, who's an underrepresented people group? Where is their suffering in the world, and how can that be? How can healing be brought to it through a movie? Now, I know the movie in itself isn't going to save lives or change or bring, you know, water or bring food to areas on the Native reservations that need it. But if the film can create awareness and can create empathy towards a people group that a lot of people don't even know are there or that exist, then that can be a great success, I think. I have two daughters. I have four kids now. We just had twins 6 months ago. But when I wrote this film, I just had my two older girls. And I also wanted to, like the whole white male, I wanted to represent women in that. I wanted to make something that my girls could look up to someday and say, man, what an awesome character. Like, what a great, you know, people. And they have flaws and they have struggles, but like, look what they overcame and look how much fun they had doing it. So I wanted to write about women. I wanted to write about minorities and, you know, Utah. It's impossible to do a Western in Utah without like paying a lot of attention to Native American people. So it all kind of came together really quick, what the story was going to be based on, what the background of the character was going to be. And then from there, it was just writing a story that was entertaining also. So it's a lot I was trying to bite off here with this. But that's what I felt passionate about doing. It's like taking this very important social issue, but putting it in a film that's exciting, that has stakes, that if you just want to show up and watch something that's entertaining, you can do that. And you can eat your popcorn and go, great, that was fun. And you can walk out, because unfortunately, that's where a lot of people leave it, because they, you know, they need it. Want to be entertained by something and watch it and move on. But what I hope is that even for the person who is just showing up watching, that this does open their eyes just a little bit to someone different than them. And, you know, and like I said, that this is something that can create empathy. That's been my hope for it.
It's interesting that you talked about those particular things, you know, the natives and the women. Obviously, those were the main characters. But I actually was really impressed as I was watching through it. I thought, well, first of all, he's got a largely native cast, which I really liked. I kind of got vibes, and obviously I felt like an obvious vibe, especially with two women riding through southern Utah, for Thelma and Louise, just a little tiny bit. But also, you know, as I was watching it and you know, some of the things that were happening, I kind of got Killers of the Flower Moon vibe, you know, where you're talking about wrongs that are being done to a group of people. Yeah. And, you know, what kind of impact does that have and how do they take it? And it's an easy thing, you know, look at all these terrible things that happen to the people. But, you know, I've always thought that when they're shown with dignity and those kinds of things, I really like that. Now maybe that's a simplistic view from another white guy who lives in Utah. But I thought that there was a lot of respect shown towards the culture, and that I personally thought as I watched this that it was trying to do more than that. And I'm curious, how do your native cast members, how do they feel like it was represented now that they've seen the final product?
Yeah, thanks for seeing that and feeling that. It needed to be genuine, for sure. And for me, that meant being quiet in a lot of these early meetings that we had about the film. And Charles Robinson is a Choctaw native from Oklahoma, and he was a big part of the story development. So I would, you know, outline the script, write it, and then go to him and say, hey, here's what I'm thinking. Here's how I'd like the plot to function to best represent these characters and display who they are and show what they're after. And here's their motivations. And he'd go, well, okay, I see what you're trying to do, but, you know, have you considered this? Or have you looked at that? Or for me, it was this. And, you know, when I was growing up, and that was just so, so helpful and honestly essential, you know, to doing this. I would not have wanted to write this if I didn't have that personal experience to pull from and to put into, or like, not my own personal experience, Charles's personal experience. And then we also had a Navajo cultural consultant, Carla Bia from North Arizona, I think Window Rock, Arizona, or maybe that's where Harold's from. Sorry, we had two. Harold plays one of the cast, and he speaks Diné, which is the Navajo language, fluently. And then Carla was there, who also speaks fluently, and she helped coach some of the actors who didn't know how to speak it. So we had a strong native presence on really throughout the entire film. Like any time we were depicting the Navajo people, someone, you know, Navajo was there to help, you know, pay it, you know, and answer questions and react to how it looks and how it feels. And you asked how they felt about it. It's been incredible from the beginning. Everyone's just, I think, been so excited. Just, oh, great, you're telling a story about us, about our people. How can we help? We want to be involved with this. We want to help tell this story and push it forward. So the response has been great. And Harold, Harold came to the premiere in Nashville, at Nashville Film Festival. And he told me after, he said, Jesse, he said this, and he brought his children, or his grandchildren with him. He had a big family. And he told me after, he said, my daughter never left the reservation. This is her first time leaving. And I was just so impressed. Wow. You know, that's incredible. I felt so honored. And he, you know, he kind of got quiet, and I was like, well, that's great. And this was at the end of the night, he was going to leave. And I said, well, you know, thank you so much again. Like, I, you know, hope to see you again, and gave him a hug. And he just stood there and kind of looked down, and I said, all right, is everything good, Harold? And he goes, yeah. He goes, Jesse, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me. Yeah. And it hit me right in the gut, because for him to, you know, be involved with this, to work for months on the film, and then, you know, 2 years later, bring his family off the res, bring them out to Tennessee to watch the film and see himself in it and see his people's story told. You could just feel you could feel how much it meant to him through those words. And I choked up when he said it. I just said, man, I'm so glad that this was such an important experience and something that you're so proud of. Cause that's, you know, and as the people have asked me before, what's been like the highlight of doing this whole movie, and what's been good about it, or, and that story always comes to mind, because really, like, that's worth it right there. And that's why I wanted to make this, is four stories like that. And so moments like that can happen.
Well, that's a really neat story. Let's do this. We got to take a break really quick here. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about specific cast members, because as you were saying that, it actually made me think of a couple of questions that I wanted to ask you, you know, both about how you chose the cast and stuff like that. So we're going to take a break here on this Movie Show Bonus Extra, and we'll be right back with Jesse Edwards, the writer, director, and a lot of other things. And we'll talk about that too, Jesse, because you were also the cinematographer, and I've got some questions about that as well, because I think people are going to be really impressed with what they see. So we'll do that on the Movie Show Bonus Extra after this.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards. Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Did you know you can get the three things you need to know delivered right to you? Just go to kslnewsradio.com, click on menu, and then newsletter.
Or go to the KSL News Radio app, and you click on menu, and then it's email alerts.
This is even easier. Just text the word inbox to 57500.
Get the top national and local stories with the three things you need to know newsletter.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind. Until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Movie Show. It is not a donut hole, but a smaller donut with its own hole. And our donut is not a hole at all. On KSL News Radio.
Andy Farnsworth on The Movie Show. Bonus extra, digital subscribers only. Talking with the Stolen Valley writer-director, Jesse Edwards. Jesse, your cast. So let's just give, for people who haven't seen the movie, just a little bit about each character. Our main character is Lupe. She's Mexican and Navajo. We meet her as a mechanic. Her mother, Adamina, who's played by Paula Miranda. Oh, and Lupe is played by, now make sure I say this right, Brisa Covarrubias.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Brisa Covarrubias. You can roll the R if you want.
Covarrubias, okay. Then Adamina's mom is played by Paula Miranda. And then at some point, as Lupe is looking for some help, she runs across a cowgirl named Maddie, played by Ally Sutton Heathcoat. Is it Heathcoat or Heathcoat?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got it right.
Heathcoat. Okay. And then at some point, they have to talk to a guy named Carl, played by Micah Fitzgerald. And at some point,
that one's actually Mika. Mika Fitzgerald. Yeah.
Ah, see, I did them all right. And then the one that.
Yeah. Okay. I know. The one that you think that you'll get, that's the tricky one.
And then we meet a character who lives on Carl's land named Lizette, who's played by Paulette Lamorey. Mm-hmm. And that was actually one who I was really impressed with, was Paulette's performance as Lizette. I really enjoyed watching her. And that's when I was talking before about the question
good.
And the representation with dignity. I felt like she conveyed a lot of that in her portions, and especially in some of her close-ups and some of her reaction shots. That's where I was really impressed with that.
She's fantastic, and everyone you mentioned is just great to work with, and they all care about this project so much. So, yeah,
Maddie almost looks almost like model-esque. Sometimes that took me a tiny bit out of it.
Yeah.
She looked a little too pretty, you know, for being on the run sometimes. A minor complaint, certainly, mm-hmm. and not a bad one, but it was just like, come on, she was just running. Wouldn't her hair be a little more mussed up than that? Again, and they're not complaints. They kind of made me chuckle that she looked really good for having been chased by some bad guys.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the movies are full of those. And there were some of them where, you know, we just eventually found ourselves laughing at them, too, because at some point that's what you did and you have to move on. For example, one of the guys that's with Lito gets shot in the leg at least once, maybe twice. And he's got this white, you know, like bandage that he holds on it. And then later we shot a scene, we took it out. But after Allie gets shot in the leg, she had the same bandage. And then, you know, James, one of the characters, had, we're like, what is this? Like the magic white napkin that they put on their flesh wound. And now they're fine. It was one of those things where like, we need them to be hurt. We need them to be shot, but they got more, you know, things to do. I don't want them to be dead yet. Some of those things absolutely are throughout the film. And for every, you know, one that someone calls out, there's probably 20 that me and the editor, you know, talked about for months and tried to get rid of. And you just kind of hope that they don't ruin the experience for people.
So talk to me about the cast. What about each of your leads made you feel like they were the right choice for the character? You wrote the characters, you created them. So as you cast each of these, Lupe, Maddie, Carl, and Lizette, what made you feel like they were the right choice for those characters that you created?
Breeza she had all the experience on her resume. That was the first thing that caught our eye, was we needed to find someone who, some sort of firearm or fight experience, motorcycle experience, the dance experience.
Oh, that's true. That's a key part in one of the scenes.
Bilingual. Yes. And she had all of it. Now, I will say a couple other people had all of them. But Breeza had the ability to very quickly to have this soft spoken nature to her. She's nothing like Maddie. She's the kind of person, she's introverted. She's kind of shy. She's kind of like, hey, I'm going to do my thing and you do yours. But when she needs to, when something's important to her, she's fierce and she's got a lot of passion and all this energy comes out. So that was, Breeza was able to do that very quickly in her self-tape that she sent in. And one of the hard things about casting this was it was all self-tape and it was all videos just sent in, and that was hard because it's much, 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 much better to just be in the room with somebody and, you know, feel their energy and actually, you know, see them clearly, you know. So that was difficult about this, but Breeza right away, like she was I think we cast her faster than any other role, and she's the main role, and that I not because we were rushing it, it was just because she was that spot on. She literally felt, looked, sounded, did all the things that Lupe did as soon as we talked to her. So that was just like a huge, that was wind in the sails when we found her for it. Because we're like, oh, great. Like we have our lead, you know, she's awesome.
So how about
Allie, I've worked with before. Allie, I've worked with before, and there was a lot of, we had a lot of different Maddies that we looked at. There was more auditions for that. Than any other spot. What I loved about Allie in that role was it was extremely close between all of the other Maddies that we talked to. And there were some that were more, you know, fierce and then looked fierce. Allie, you know, does model work and does photography and she doesn't have, you don't see her on the street and go, oh, watch out for that girl. That's not the reaction. We had a lot of like very intimidating, more muscular, more fierce, more intimidating Maddies that auditioned for it. And, you know, there was, again, a lot of skills needed there, firearms, horses, bikes, some, you know, experience with all those things. We knew we needed to move quick. We did have a stunt team, but we weren't going to be like, we needed the leads to be able to do quite a bit of stuff in order just to make our days and get everything done and to do it well. Allie had all of that. She was willing to do it all, had experience in almost all of it. What it came down to for Allie, and that was, I'd say, the hardest one to cast. What it came down to was in the audition process, because we had multiple callbacks with multiple Maddies, she was the best to work with. And she was able to bring the sadness quickly and do it really well. There's some tender moments with Maddie in the film. She nailed that. She was able to turn on her voice and to be loud and be intense. And another thing, I think Maddie's hilarious. I think her trying to speak Spanish is very funny. And I think her trying to, you know, when she teases Lupe, she gets her laughing and they have these very light moments together. And that Allie did better than anybody else that I had talked to. So I love that about her and her ability to turn in between them so quickly, and her open spirit on all of the auditions that we did with her was like, man, we're going to be spending months with this person doing this role. She's the one that we want involved with this project. So
I thought she transitioned really well between the kind of action portion and the vulnerable portions pretty well. I thought, you know, as I, especially when I watched some of the smaller, you know, the smaller produced movies, you see times where you're like, okay, they're going to be less experienced typically than, you know, your Academy Award nominees, obviously, but, but you can also see times where you're like, you know, because there's moments where you're like, all right, it reminds you that it was a smaller budget. But then there's times where you're like, I can see why they cast him. Like this scene right here, you can see what you, that's when you feel fully immersed in the movie. And I thought she had a lot of those different scenes. And there were a couple of times, like I said, when sometimes, you know, maybe the makeup was just a little too nice to kind of distract a little bit. But there were also some times where I thought she does this all right. And I thought the same thing about Lupe and Brisa, who did kind of the whole range again. And then Carl, let's get to Carl. So Mika Fitzgerald.
Sure.
I kind of thought sometimes he bordered on the mustache twirling evildoer of putting Polly Pearhart on the railroad tracks. Yeah. And that may have been intentional. But he was also pretty frightening at times.
I love Carl's voice. I think it's incredible. And Antonio, too. We won't have time to talk about him, but he's kind of the Mexican loan shark cartel, you know, leader. What it doesn't say exactly what he's doing, but he works in the back of a pawn shop.
Matty owes him money.
Matty's life. Yeah, right. right. So Antonio has an incredible voice. And Carl's voice, I loved so much. And we had we might have had more Carl's audition than Maddie's now that I say it. Or maybe it was hundreds for each of those. And man, there were so many, and we looked at a lot. And he wasn't initially selected as one of the top picks. And I think we had a group of 10, and we're going through them, and we had done a couple callbacks with a couple others, and it didn't feel scary enough with some of these other actors I had talked to. And I went back through the self tapes and I saw just a thumbnail of his. And I thought, who's that guy? That guy looks like a bad guy. Like he looks like the guy, you know, the girl tied up on the train. Like he looks like this is like the caricature, like bad Western guy.
He had a good sneer.
He's got a lot of texture on his
face.
Like
the way his upper lip would curl up.
I totally get that. Some people have reacted that way. And then I've had other people say, like, he's the absolute best. They're like, wow, how did you get that guy? He was so incredible. Like, I loved watching Mika in this film. And you kind of have to go with your instincts and go with what you think works best and come up with a decision and then be confident in it. And in the casting process, without being able to meet everybody and go through it and really rehearse, he looked the meanest, and we needed someone who, you know, he has to be capable of being willing to murder people very close to him and be very harsh with it. And he's representing, and it's funny because he's the nicest guy. And Mika said to me before, he's like, why does Hollywood keep making me the bad guy? You know, like, it's just, like I'm like looking in the mirror and I'm like, come on, like, do I really look that bad? Like I've got to kill who today? When we're looking at scripts, you know, and
he's like, I could lead a rom-com. Totally.
I know. Yeah. That's what we said. We're like, you know, we got to find a project for you, Mika. He looks the part. I think the things he needed to do, he looks like he's someone who could be capable of doing that.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. Like, despite the mustache twirling comment, he really was frightening at other times, like very believable in the, this is not a guy you want to mess with. And he looks like he's the kind of guy that's willing to go farther. And as the person who's going to oppose him, are you willing to go as far as he looks like he's willing to go?
Yeah. And he's representing a very, you know, racist, you know, evil idea or belief system. And really, you know, I think, you know, I said racist. It's really, you know, selfishness to the extreme where you don't care about anyone else. And that starts to, you know, become extra harsh on people that are in your way or people who don't look like you or don't. And you know, he's really, I feel like
he's an equal opportunity jerk, though. He's pretty jerky to the people that look like him also.
Right. I was just going to say that. Like, I think he's taking advantage of the Native American group because he can, not because he's necessarily is out to get them. But yeah, he's
that to me was where it had similarities to Killers of the Flower Moon. That's where I felt like the vibe was very similar, where it wasn't necessarily malice, but it was one of those things where a certain group is feeling like this other group, they're not sophisticated enough to understand the things that they have. So this is where we should come in and, you know, take care of this for them.
Yeah. And, you know, give them some of the money. But it would be, you know, it'd be foolish to not, because they're not taking, you know, advantage
right.
of this
in their kind of arrogance.
The connections. Yeah. You can, you can see how they could justify it, and how they, if they, you know, stop caring about people enough times, you get to a point really quick where you're willing to do whatever to take it away from them and to push your own self forward. And I always, people would ask, well, what's the motivation for, or like, what's the motivation for this character? Who is this guy? And I'd say, you know, do you remember Forrest Gump and the film, and you remember Jenny and the scene where he runs to go be with her and sees her at the house, and she lives in that trailer and her dad lives there. And he's like, Jenny, you never see her dad, but she runs out to a cornfield and they pray they can get away. And I would say that's the house Carl grew up in. And like he was raised by the same guy, and he I try to always start there with characters. Like, what kind of, you know, upbringing do they have? What kind of emotional trauma do they have?
As an audience, we don't generally think about that, but as a writer, you have to kind of figure that out so that you can decide what they're going to do in the situations that you're putting them in.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's one line, like in terms of Carl's motivation, there's one line that we snuck in where the oil guy, Mills is his name, represents the oil company. And he goes, okay, like, buying this land, but what about the locals? Like, where are they going to go? And Carl answers, Carl's not even thinking about the natives who live there. He says, oh, well, me and my boy are going to be moving. I hear the Caribbean's nice all year long. And Mills is like, what? No, not you. Like the Indians. Like, it's not going to look good at us asking them to leave.
And, his reply was, we got another buyer if you're not interested. That was his reply.
Right. Yeah. And that's where he takes it. And it's just, how can I get as much money out of this as possible? I haven't seen Killers of the Flower Moon, by the way, but a friend of mine saw it. And I know generally what it's about, and based on a true story. I didn't know that specific story. But a friend of mine saw it. They said, hey, they're like, isn't that exactly what you wrote about with Carl in that movie? That really reminded me of The Stolen Valley. And they explained it. And I said, yeah, I said, I didn't base that on an actual event, but that's the literal backstory for the film. And there's pieces it doesn't explain at all. We had some scenes that explained more. We ended up taking it out because it wasn't necessary. But Carl went to work for Adamina's dad and started up a relationship with her with the intent, knowing that she would inherit this land, with the intent to get it from her.
And that's
exactly, you know, when you see her go to meet with him and tell him, hey, I'm actually pregnant, that's when she sees, you know, something that changes everything. And that's why I'm trying not to spoil.
Yeah,
no,
I was going to say, I've been trying to be vague just a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I might have gone too far there, but that's, you know, that's it's the same motivation that they had in Killers, from what I understand. You know, someone trying to get in with the family to get the land and inherit it and use it for their own gain.
Well, one thing I want to pay,
and you know, apparently it happens on a pretty big scale.
Yeah, I was going to say, those probably aren't the only two instances of that kind of a thing, the Osage Nation and the Navajo Nation being victimized by those who's decided that they know better than you do, and so they should come in and try to handle this kind of stuff. But I was going to say, for a story that you created, one of the biggest compliments that I wanted to give was, for an original story, you did a really good job of weaving things in that there was a couple of twists that I certainly didn't expect. But I also didn't feel, when they happened, like, oh, come on. Because I have felt that way when I've seen some twists before in movies, where it's like, no, that's a little too convenient. But I did feel like the twists you put in here, I want to compliment you on the way you plotted it, the way you introduced the characters, and then some of the ties between characters that I didn't expect, but that didn't feel unearned.
Oh, thank you. That's a huge compliment, and it's a huge compliment to the editor, Zach Pritchard, a great friend and a fantastic editor. And they say you write a movie, you know, three times, once when you actually are writing it, again on set, you redo all those decisions you have to. And then the third time you write it is in post, when you're editing the thing. And that's the only one that people get to see. And there was an incredible amount of surgery and rearranging of what the story was to get it. And we worked on that specifically, like how are we introducing these characters and how much are we showing and when are we showing it? When are we revealing to the audience that this character wants this or that they know that? And all of those things, like getting the math of that right is what makes those twists work or not work. And there, you know, there's things we, of course, there's things we wish we could have done better. And when we were doing that, you know, the editing, the third writing of the script, we were like, man, if only we would have got this or that. And you start to see those things, you know, clearer than ever. So for you to compliment that specifically is a huge compliment. And most of it's owed to Zach Pritchard.
I'm still a critic, technically. So I did feel like some of the dialogue was a little clunky. So did my colleague, Steve. But Steve wanted to make sure that I let you know he also was surprised how much he enjoyed it. And we wanted to talk about the cinematography. We have to take one more quick break here on the Movie Show Bonus Digital Extra so that when we come back, I want to talk about the cinematography because you were also the cinematographer among the many hats that you wore on The Stolen Valley. So we'll be right back with Jesse Edwards, writer, director, and cinematographer of The Stolen Valley here on the Movie Show Bonus Extra.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Did you know you can get the three things you need to know delivered right to you? Just go to KSLNewsRadio.com, click on menu, and then newsletter.
Or go to the KSL News Radio app, and you click on menu, and then it's email alerts.
This is even easier. Just text the word inbox to 57500.
Get the top national and local stories with the three things you need to know newsletter.
The murder of two men forces their families to wrestle with impossible questions. Who is forgiveness for? Does everyone deserve a second chance? Follow season two of The Letter, Ripple Effect, at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the world famous KSL Movie Show on KSL News Radio.
World famous. We've definitely got at least one listener outside the United States, and it's my brother who lives in England. But nevertheless, having said that, I do want to play a clip. We're talking with Jesse Edwards, who is the writer, director, and cinematographer for The Stolen Valley, which released in Utah on February 23rd at multiple theaters. And it's a he didn't want to, Jesse, you didn't want to make it it's not really a Western. It's kind of a neo-Western, but there's some crime, there's drama. It's a multi-hyphenate type of genre. And that's fair because you were a multi-hyphenate role in making this movie as the writer, as the director, as the producer, as the executive producer, and the cinematographer. By any chance, were you the caterer also?
No. Okay. So that would be fun. Maybe another time. Yeah.
So talking about the cinematography, actually, you know what? I want to play a little clip from The Stolen Valley here.
Oh, exciting.
When our people moved to the reservation, there were some elders who wanted a different life. They found their new home in the heart of Alta Valley.
You're the landowner here?
Why are you here?
My mother. She's very sick. cancer. And
you said that. But why are you here?
Drop the price on my head. I'll blow his all over the floor.
You shouldn't have done that, Maddie.
The only way out is to go out guns blazing, you understand? I don't want to shoot them! Well, they don't exactly share your morals! Just can't shoot everyone! You want to go get this money or not?
That's some of the action, the snappy writing, and the humor. Unfortunately, because we're in an audio format, I can't show people some of the amazing visuals that are a part of the Stolen Valley. But that's what I wanted to ask you about next, Jesse, which was, first of all, what was your prior cinematography experience before the Stolen Valley? Because I was really impressed with some of your overhead shots, in particular those that incorporated the landscape, Utah landscape, into scenes, especially those vehicle scenes. You talked about the motorcycle riding, but I remember thinking, like, I really like how he's framing these shots so that you can see the terrain backdrop, the gorgeous red sand, or some of the bluffs and the blue sky. And I really was impressed with did you use a drone, or was that like chopper, some of that?
That was a drone. Yeah. All of that was drone. Thank you so much. That's a sweet compliment. And my cinematography experience, that's actually what I start. Well, I started as an editor, you know, long, long time ago. And then quickly started, you know, shooting after that. And it was, you know, weddings and that kind of thing. I was like, you know, 18 years old. So before that, as a kid, just making movies at home with my brothers, that it was, you know, you have to do all of it. I don't know, having a camera in my hands has always been normal for me. And then I started doing documentaries for ESPN. Like, if you've seen like little E60 sports features and or like 30 for 30s, things like that. So I've shot quite a bit, for years. I just did that. And it wasn't until probably 2015 or 2016 that I started, you know, transitioning to directing, pretty much full time from then on. But a lot of that included directing and DPing. And because it was sometimes easier, sometimes faster. Always cheaper for, like, if you're doing a short form documentary and you need, you know, if you have to get, you know, two people or one person, like, you're going to go with one. It's just, you can divide and conquer that way. And you can do more. So just as a, you know, function of being a commercial and documentary filmmaker, it's always been a huge advantage that I've had the technical knowledge to be able to operate, camera and lensing and all of that. I'm not a very technical DP, so in terms of explaining how exactly all of it works and sensor size and color space and all of that, I know enough about it to have the right conversations and get the right people involved to
hey, that's make part
it
of the talent.
But yeah. Thank you. Yeah, there are. I don't consider myself a DP. I did it for years, but it was because I needed to or wanted to tell that story or to finish that project. And directors of photography, it's an incredible skill, and it's different than I think what my natural skills are. But in terms of, you know, like photography, I've done in terms of framing things, in terms of being able to, you know, to know where I want to have the camera and having the instincts to put it there, that I feel like I have, and I can do that. And I usually do that on my project. It wasn't my hope to DP this. I think when you're wearing that many hats, you can't do any of the jobs as well as you'd want to. Like, just your time gets divided and you're not going to be able to be as fully present in any of the roles when you have that many. Our DP for this project, someone I'd worked with before, he actually backed out a few days before I flew out to get to Utah. And that was a big blow for us. But I think it was a blessing in disguise, because we were then able to move so much faster faster. I think it's better when you have someone who's in that role. I've directed lots of projects with, you know, DPs and hired DPs and have great relationships with a lot of DPs. That's the best way to work. It's a full-time job, and it should be. But on this film, for how short amount of time we had, just at every location, and what we had to, you know, get done in a day just to make our day, it was extremely beneficial for me to be able to walk in. The first thing I do is talk with Aaron Seldon, our camera operator, and Colin Knoll, and I'd say, okay, guys, here's what I'm thinking. We're looking this direction. I'd bring Allie and Breeza over, whoever the talent was, bring them over. You're going to stand here. You're going to stand here. We're going to start this way. We're going to do these lines, and then we're going to transition to this, and then we block that, and we block that. And while I was doing it, I'd have my phone out, or I'd have sometimes I'd have the camera built for me, and I'd walk and I'd, you know, handheld show, hey guys, I'm thinking about here, waist height. When she walks this way, let her leave, and we'll pick her up over there. Yeah, I basically, like, we'd do a full blocking, and we'd rehearse it really quick, you know, just take a few minutes to do it. And while I'm doing that, the cam ops are watching, the gaffer's watching, the key grip's watching, hair and makeup are watching, and they all now know, okay, here's the game plan. And then I could transition into a, you know, to a director seat, and we could rehearse line, or just usually we'd go right into it, and then give notes to that. And I've worked with Aaron and Colin, and Justin was our gaffer for most of it. Mike Weldon helped with the rest. I've worked with them enough, and we had enough references, and we had enough conversation prior to where we knew they knew what I liked in terms of quality of light, how soft it is, where we're doing hard edges, when we're being more dramatic with the scene, and when we just need to move quick and to get it done. So we had a very fluent language on all of that, and yeah, we were able to move really fast, and I would not have been able to be in the DP role without such an incredible crew, and a crew that knows that I've worked with before and the experience that I have with them. But yeah. And then, you know, also the other thing I'd say, you talked about some of the framing. We were so quick with a lot of, like you mentioned, the high landscape shots, and we did not have a lot of time for those, that we snuck those in. It was not like, hey, now's the day where we get all the landscape shots. It was not like that. Those were 12, 14 hour days where, while we were loading out, we said, hey, let's get the drone up and get that shot now, so we don't have to come back here. Or hey, we've got 8 minutes before the sun goes down. Let's get the drone up now, even though it's the end of the day. Let's put it up and try to get that shot. So we were rushed with all of those, but I think when you come from a documentary background, that's kind of the normal, and you're used to having to use your instincts, frame things up well and do it quickly and get the shot and move on. So it was very fast moving, and it's always a huge compliment when people are like, wow, the cinematography is so great. I'm always relieved when I hear that, because we had a lot of plans and a lot of things we wanted to do that we weren't able to pull off.
Well, the good news is that we don't know any of those things, so we can just appreciate it so much easier than you can with that. And that's one great other thing, Steve, my co-host Steve wanted to point out, and I agree with him on this, was it was a very excellent score, musical score.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I absolutely love the score. Ryan Taubert is the composer. I've worked with him on a few other projects, commercial projects, and man, he is so talented. It's one of my favorite things. He is going to release it at some point, and you'll be able to stream it or buy it to listen. And I'm like, man, Ryan, when's it coming out? Because I'm going to buy several copies of this thing. It is such a good score. I'm glad you guys liked it. I felt like really just like humbled that he's worked on some very big movies. So for me to be able to meet him when I did, and him be able to, you know, be willing to help out with this, is super, super cool.
Well, Jesse, where can people get tickets and watch the film? Do you got a list of where in Utah?
Yeah, it's going to be at the Megaplex Theaters up in North Utah, and actually South too. So it's in like Thanksgiving Point, Jordan Commons. It's also at the Megaplex down in Cedar City. I think there's 5 or 6 theaters it's at. But yeah, you can, you know, go to their site, look up The Stolen Valley. It's in for a week, maybe a week and a half now to start. And then if people actually go see the thing, they'll extend it. So it would mean a lot if people checked it out and gave it a chance.
I think it does a good job. As somebody who has 6 kids myself, again, I have the twins. My twins are about to turn 11.
Wow.
So, you know, a family, being able to watch something with the family is really important to me. And it's PG-13. And this is an interesting thing, too. I'm usually language sensitive, but I thought this was one of the few times I've ever watched a movie where the F word was earned, like it made sense for the scene.
Wow.
I it's weird for me to admit that, but when I heard it, I was like,
yeah,
you know what? That's exactly the right word for that scene. Like any other use in the movie, and it might have felt wrong for the scene where it was, it
I
made perfect
like
sense.
Either. Yeah, I don't like it either. And I it felt real to the world and real to the characters.
I felt like if the character had said something else, it would have almost felt like a cop-out because of, it's a key, I don't want to spoil anything, but trust me, this one's okay. This one's okay.
Oh, thanks for saying that. Yeah, and I hope families, you know, can watch it too. And it's PG-13, but I think it's important. It's an important story. And like you said, if it's earned, and even if you think it's not earned, I think it's an important story, and it's worth giving a watch. I hope people don't turn away because, I don't know.
No, and that's why I wanted to make sure I put that in there so that they understood, like, as I watched it, there's times where I watch stuff and I'm just like, oh, man, now I'm going to have struggle because, who am I going to recommend this to? But that was one time where I thought, you know what? I can't disagree. That was that. It just fit. It fit. So that's all I got to say about that because I would rarely say this, but I thought it was appropriate.
Thank you. That's a huge compliment. But I hope your kids like it if they get to see it.
Oh, they'll get a chance to see it. I make them watch a lot of stuff that I watch.
That's good.
Well,
that's
congratulations. Good. Is it cool to see it up on the big screen after watching it in the camera lenses and on the...
Yeah, the monitors.
The audience.
And it's really cool. It's we thought this would be going straight to a streamer. And we said, hey, let's try theaters. Let's try to get 10. And then, you know, that had been up to 15, then it went up to 20. And, you know, this week we're in 90 now. And that's just come together in the last, 48 hours. So that's surreal for it to be available, select theaters. But we're in 30 states. And I'm able to call up old friends and be like, hey, this is actually playing, 15 minutes from you.
Make sure you tell people,
That's surreal.
Well, that is great, Jesse. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the movie show, and congratulations on The Stolen Valley. Best of luck to you. I hope that enough people get to see it so that you can get a little bit longer run, because it is one, don't let not having heard of it stop you, because it's a pretty well-told tale with some gorgeous visuals, and especially for those of us here in Utah who want to enjoy the gorgeous vistas that our state provides, you get a chance to see it again on the big screen in The Stolen Valley.
All right. Thanks so much, Andy. This was awesome.
All right, Jesse. Good luck to you.
All right. Thanks.
Well, thank you for joining for this extra movie show bonus digital extra. For Steve Sales, I'm Andy Farnsworth, and we invite you to join us on the movie show at its regular time on KSL News Radio on Fridays from 11 to 1, or as you may have discovered since you're listening to this, we're also available wherever you get your podcasts at kslpodcasts.com or anywhere that you subscribe. Just search for KSL Movie Show, and then you can hear us every week and with these bonus digital extras like this. We'll catch you next time.